Exodus 32:1 through 32:6, The Golden Calf. The 24th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on July 20, 1997 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1997. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're looking at chapter 32 of Exodus. This is a story that I have been long wanting to get to. I've been pleased that over the last few months, it seems like a number of pieces of the puzzle of understanding the Pentateuch have kind of fallen together for me, and some things have made more sense than they have ever in the past. And so I've been looking forward to getting to this passage because it's one that has long intrigued me. It's the making of the golden calf while Moses is up on the mountain. But as I was looking at this passage, I was making good progress at the beginning, and then as I was writing up my notes for speaking today, I began to have second thoughts about a lot of my conclusions. So this is not going to be a lecture. This is going to be a work session. And so I encourage you to roll up your sleeves and we'll all dive in here. It might be helpful for me to point out, it's something that I have mentioned before, but for some reason I feel better if I reiterate it from time to time. And that is, the only way I feel comfortable standing up here and talking is if I view what I'm doing as being a tour guide. That is, I'm just taking you through the text and pointing out, here's a verse on the right and here's one on the left, and et cetera, et cetera. And I contrast that in my thinking to being more like a filmmaker. If I were a filmmaker, I would be telling you what you will see, and the rest of the room is black. All you can see is what's right there in front of you, and I'm framing that and I'm dictating exactly what you're looking at. I feel much more comfortable in this tour guide mode where I'm pointing out some things, but I'm encouraging you to look around as we go through this as well and to think about what's happening here and to try to put the pieces together yourself. So I'm definitely in tour guide mode today. The reason that this story has been intriguing to me is we have a situation in which God has acted extremely dramatically in the lives of this group of people. Probably more dramatically than in the lives of any group of people in history. God has been really obviously present. They have seen a lot of miracles in a relatively short period of time. From the time that the plagues began until the time here at Mount Sinai, it's probably been about a year. Since the Red Sea, the crossing of the Red Sea to here at Mount Sinai, it's been about 3 months. So God has been very obviously present in their lives, very dramatically present, in a very compact period of time. And yet, we have an obvious act of disobedience that takes place. And what are they thinking? What's going on? That's what's always intrigued me about this story. How could this happen? What's going on in their minds that would justify this to themselves? Well, let's try to sort this out and see if we can make some progress. Let me remind you of the context. God brought the people of the descendants of Abraham out of Egypt with following a series of plagues that he inflicted upon the Pharaoh to allow them to go, even though the Pharaoh really was reluctant and at the end did not want them to go. There are a number of times when God intervenes, the first to save them, the first being the opening of the Red Sea so that they can pass through and be spared from the army of Pharaoh. And then there are a number of incidents as they are making their way across the desert where God intervenes. But God brings them to Mount Sinai, and here at Mount Sinai, he is going to make them his people. And he's going to make them his people by presenting to them the law, that is, his moral code and his set of customs and traditions that he is establishing that will make them a distinctive people. So they are receiving these commandments here at Mount Sinai. And the commandments came in three parts. The first group was the Ten Commandments, and those were delivered directly by God to the people of Israel. They heard his voice. The second group of commandments, he delivered to Moses and had them then relay those on to the people of Israel. And those are the moral commandments, the description of what is a just and unjust society. Then the third group, Moses leaves again then, having delivered those, that second group of commandments, to which, by the way, the people of Israel reiterated their statement, we will do all that you have said. Now this third group of commandments have to do with the making of a tabernacle. God gives instructions as to how this portable tabernacle, this portable temple is to be constructed and what's supposed to be in it. And in particular, there is the Ark of the Covenant that will be in it. And the Ark of the Covenant is this little box about this big, overlaid with gold on the top. There are several things that are to be stored in it later on, the law being one of those things. And it has two cherubim standing on both sides of this, on the top, on both sides, with their wings outstretched. And that is the mercy seat between the cherubim. That's where God is present. So that's one of the things that will be in this portable temple. And then he talks about what the priests are supposed to wear and what they're supposed to do. Okay, these are the instructions that Moses is receiving on Mount Sinai in this third installment of the law. And he has gone up there with and is receiving those from God, and there are two or three attendants that are waiting just down the hillside. And he's been gone for 40 days. These are detailed instructions. And obviously, this is a time period that exceeded what the Israelites had expected. And so the events then that we hear, that I'm going to read about in chapter 32, occur after Moses has been gone these 40 days receiving this third installment of the law. And here's what happens. I'll read the first few verses. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. remember what the conditions are of when this event is happening. They are in the middle of the desert. And this is particularly significant in that these are primarily city people. These are not desert people. These are people that were born and raised, well, not in the heart of Egypt, but on the fringes of Egypt, but they certainly are not accustomed to the desert. The desert is a foreign place to them and probably quite forbidding. They have only been in the desert for 2 or 3 months. And up to now, the whole time that they have been in the desert, they have had Moses with them. And Moses seems to have leadership ability, but he also has experience of the desert. If you will recall, Moses spent 40 years living in Egypt as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. But then he spent 40 years as a shepherd in this very area that they are passing through. In fact, the burning bush, when God appeared to Moses in the burning bush, it was at this same mountain. So Moses is very familiar with this area. So he has been their guide. And now Moses has been missing for 40 days. And they're thinking, he's gone. He's been eaten by an animal or something's happened to him. Furthermore, throughout this journey in the wilderness, Moses has been the go-between between God and the people. It has been very rare that God has interacted with the people directly. In almost all instances, God speaks to Moses and Moses then commands the people. And when the people complain, they complain to Moses, and Moses takes those complaints to God. So communication between the people and God is all funneled through Moses, and Moses is God. So I think that Moses' absence is a really... Well, they were not terribly fond of Moses, the Israelites. There are many indications in which they questioned Moses' judgment and what he had done. So it's not that he was the most popular person in the group, but it was rather he was the best qualified to be the leader. And they followed him on the basis of his authority granted by God, rather than on the basis of his popularity. But Moses is gone. And the fact that they don't have that kind of capable leadership and that go-between between them and God that is making this a particularly serious situation. One that's beginning to make the Israelites wonder whether they're going to perish here in the desert. Is it the case that God has brought us out here and now we're abandoned and we're going to die? I suspect that's the mindset that they have going into this. And the importance of being able to contact God, I think, is really significant here. They've lost that ability, the way they're seeing it. They've lost the ability to make their needs known to God. In ancient history, it is not uncommon for the second or third third highest ranking person in a society. You have the king, and then under him you have such august sounding names as cupbearer. And I've always thought, what a strange name for someone who's second in command of a society. I mean, doesn't secretary of state sound better? Or prime minister or something? But cupbearer? But when you think about it, what's important, the thing that gives a person power is access to power. The cupbearer is the one who would serve liquid refreshment to the king. So the cupbearer has access to the king many times a day. And that's significant. Why is it that in the White House there is fighting over who gets the room next to the president? Why is it that people spend big bucks to be able to have a tea at which the president attends? It's access to power. If you can have access to power, if you can make your interests known, your concerns known, your needs known, then you have a better chance of getting what you want. And what the Israelites have lost is this access to power, at least the way that they're seeing it. What exactly... Okay, so... the first verse says, "Now when the people saw..." I can't say that I have enough experience with this word, saw, in the Old Testament to speak authoritatively. But my observation has been that when you see the word saw, it rarely has anything to do with new optical data. When it says that someone saw something, it means a change in perception. It means they realize something. A new thing has occurred to them. A new insight. A new realization. So I think what it's indicating here, when it says that the people saw that Moses had delayed to come down from the mountain, that they're beginning to think about things differently. They've decided Moses is not coming back, and if Moses is not coming back, we're in real trouble. Action has to be taken. So it says in my translation, the people assembled about Aaron. I believe that's a misleading translation, because this phrase, to assemble about, it's a verb to assemble with a preposition. The preposition that is used here with the word assemble seems to mean they came in a confrontational manner. So it's more like they mobbed around Aaron. That there's something contentious about this. There's something confrontational. There's something... there's hostility here. That's the way that this verb with the preposition is always used in the Pentateuch. I will admit there are other places in the Old Testament later on when it doesn't seem to have that same connotation. But I suspect what's being hinted at here is the people came with a hostile attitude towards Aaron. They want something done. And that seems to be reinforced by the wording where it says, "Come, make us a God who will go before us." They are making a demand. They are insistent. This is what has to happen. Now, what are they thinking about when they say, "Make us a God"? Are they giving up on Yahweh? Do they want a new God now? Or is it that they want something to bring God down, bring Yahweh down, so that He's present and active right there in their midst? That's a tough one to decide. It is interesting that what they're asking for when they say, "Make us a God," they use the word Elohim. Usually in the Old Testament, Elohim is the word that's translated God. When you see the word Lord in your translation, that's the standard way of translating God's name, Yahweh. So sometimes you'll see God referred to as Elohim, sometimes you'll see Him referred to as Yahweh, and sometimes you'll see the Lord God, so Yahweh Elohim. Here it is just Elohim. And if it talks about foreign gods, it will use the word Elohim. So Elohim is the more generic. Yahweh is the more specific. And they're saying here, "Make for us Elohim, who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." The reason they need this Elohim is because Moses has disappeared. So they are saying it's because Yahweh has abandoned us. We need this Elohim because Moses has disappeared. So So there's some indications here that it seems to be pointing in the direction of it's not abandoning Yahweh, but rather it's a way of making Yahweh present here, making him responsive. Now, there is a piece of evidence that's a little bit contrary to that, and that is the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translates Elohim here with the words in the plural form, make for us gods. Make for us gods. Now, I don't want to get into a long explanation of this. I'll try to make it as simple as possible. But Elohim is a plural form. Elohim can mean either God singular or gods plural. And in the Septuagint, they chose to translate this in the plural, which is the Hebrew will allow that. And I would point out that Stephen, in the speech that he gives in Acts 7, where he is recounting all of the incidences in which the nation of Israel had shown rebelliousness against God, he refers to this account, and he quotes directly from the Septuagint with the plural form, gods. So it could be here that what they're asking for is something different from Yahweh, another god or gods. But it seems to me that there is a third option, and this is the one that I would prefer, and that is the text is stating it in a way that is kind of left open. That is to say, they don't care whether it's Yahweh or some other god. What's important to them is we want divine assistance. What they're saying is, Aaron, we demand that you take action to bring the help of God or gods. We don't care. We want divine assistance. We're in a tough spot. And I suspect that that's why we have the ambiguity in the text, that it's leaving it open, because they don't care. Aaron's response is difficult. It's not clear to me whether Aaron is complying with this, sees this as a good thing, or sees it as a bad thing. My inclination is to think that he sees this as a bad thing, but it's not obvious. What Aaron does is he says to the people, tear off the gold rings from your wives and your sons and your daughters. There are two curious things about what he says. One is, where is he getting the gold rings? He's speaking to the men of Israel, the heads of households. And this is common. The laws directed the heads of households. It's common for the leadership to dress the heads of households. He says, go get gold rings. Where from? From your wives, from your sons, and from your daughters. The only thing he leaves out is from yourselves. It's a curious omission. The other thing that's curious about this is the verb that's used is tear off, indicating some kind of force being used. And the thing that makes this particularly curious is if we look at what happens subsequently in Exodus. I hope I wrote down the place where this occurs. Subsequently in Exodus, when after Moses received the instructions with respect to the construction of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, he too makes a collection of gold and things to be used in the construction of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. But the description of his collection is quite different. Look at Exodus 35:20. Starting in verse 20. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel departed from Moses' presence, and everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting, and for all its service, and for the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and bracelets, all articles of gold. So did every man who presented an offering of gold to the Lord, etc. So the description there is quite different. Moses doesn't say tear off. He just makes the request for these items, and those whose hearts had been stirred by God brought them forth. So there's no hint of compulsion later on, and here we have a verb that indicates compulsion. Now, I don't know why that indication is there. It could be that there is fear that this will not come about unless we make it come about by force. And we have to have this come about, because if it doesn't come about, we'll perish. We, as Israelites here in the desert, know that. In any case, Aaron is compliant. Aaron issues this command. It seems to have been a command that he issues under some duress, but he nevertheless issues it. They bring the rings, and then it says in verse 4, and he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. So Aaron, here it states it in a way that's very active. It is not outside of the use of language here that he could have had a craftsman do it, that he didn't actually do the carving, etc. But the way that it's stating here is making it clear that Aaron is an active participant in what's going on. The response of the people then, in verse 4, at the end of verse 4, and they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." This seems to be indicating that the people are equating this calf that has just been constructed with Yahweh, with the God that had brought them out of Egypt. They don't use the name Yahweh, but they do attribute this to that God that brought them out of Egypt. Now, Umberto Casuto says that in Egyptian theology, the theologically informed did not believe that their idols were actually gods. They believed that the gods rode on beasts, and that if they created the beast on which their god was accustomed to riding, that he would come and be present there. So the idol and the golden calf was something that the Egyptians created. They built golden calves to be a place of presence for God, for the gods. And that the Israelites are probably imitating that same thing. They're just doing what they learned in Egypt. When you need God, when you need Him present, what do? You do what we did back when we were kids, what we saw done, and that is you build a golden calf. And that will bring Him down. That will make Him present. That will make Him hear. So it could be that that's the way they're envisioning it. It's not this. They haven't created a new God, but rather they have created a throne for Yahweh to come and be present on. Verse 5 says, now when Aaron saw this. Now this brings me back to that verb saw again. I think we have the same thing happening here. It's not input, but rather Aaron has come to a realization. He has changed his mind about something. So my suspicion is that at first it was coercion that caused him to take up this collection and have this calf made. But now there's a turn in his thinking, because he sees that they are associating what has been created with the God that brought them out of Egypt, And he says, this is a good thing. His response is, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord, Yahweh. So I think what he's doing is now embracing what's happening and saying, we are going to make this clearly a celebration of Yahweh, the God that brought us out of Egypt. So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Apparently this is the standard way of celebrating a religious occasion, and presumably this is the way that they learned to celebrate this kind of occasion in Egypt, or doing what they learned, what they were enculturated to do. So they have a meal, they drink, and then they rose up to play. And this last phrase is curious in that the verb used here, to play, can have sexual connotations. And that's a curious verb to be used here, because God had indicated earlier that he was a jealous God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Indicating that the relationship between God and his people was an exclusive relationship, analogous to a marriage. And now the people are having this religious celebration, at least ostensibly to Yahweh, but in the way that it's described using words that have a sexual connotation, which make it sound like this is more of an adulterous kind of celebration rather than a celebration of their relationship with God himself, with Yahweh. That they are celebrating this in the name of Yahweh, but in fact, this is a flagrantly rebellious celebration, a departure from what God had commanded. Let me stop here for a bit and I'd like to hear what you think about this passage, what's going on here, and observations that you have made as we've gone through here, and questions that you might have, and then we'll do something else. Logan?
It seems like at first you're saying they had a misconception about who God is and what he's like, and so that they were just behaving in their, you know, what they've grown up with towards God, which doesn't seem to be as rebellious or evil as God responds to them. I mean, it's if they had grown up with all these gods, just do this, do that, and they're like, you know, naivete doing this, it doesn't seem as bad as saying we're going to abandon God and reject God and make God or whoever dance to our tune. Or both.
Can I save that? Hopefully I'll answer, respond to that before we're done. Mm-hmm. Roger.
I think it's significant that the object of sacrifice was the calf.
That the idol that was created was a calf.
The idol was created was a calf. Mm-hmm. And then later in the temple service, the calf was being destroyed. It was like, it's like somehow God sees some kind of connection between the two. And I was wondering.
That hadn't occurred to me. That is curious. My assumption has been that they created a calf because a calf was what they would have created, that's what the Egyptians would have made in that same situation. But it is curious that a calf then becomes at least one of the sacrificial animals later on. One feature here that I cannot account for that is related to this, and that is God's punishment for the people of Israel, is to take the calf and to, what does he do, melt it down or grind it down into powder, spread it out onto the waters, and the people have to drink it. That's a curious punishment, and I'm sure that there's a reason why he chose that punishment as opposed to another one. And that could be somehow related to the image of the calf as well. Larry?
What strikes me as interesting is that Aaron first thinks he's wrong, and then he has this realization and he thinks it's right, and he's wrong. And yet when Moses confronts him about what's happened, he says, his language is that the calf just kind of appears.
Yeah, let's look at that. That's a little bit later in the chapter. Yeah, Larry is pointing out that the way I'm seeing the text is that Aaron starts out under duress, but at the end he sees it as a good thing, this that's happening. That maybe it's good that we make this calf, and then we celebrate Yahweh, the calf being a representation or the seat on which Yahweh comes. So when Moses arrives and denounces what has happened, Aaron downplays his complicity in it. And here's what he says. This is verse 21. Then Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, 'Make a god for us who will go before us.' For this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And I said to them, "Whoever has any gold, let them tear it off." So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and presto, out came this calf. I added one word there. That's from the Hebrew.
Verse 4, it's very clear that he fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into this.
Right.
So I guess my question is, could you comment on what you think happened with this?
Well, that's a really tough one. The degree of his complicity and what he's thinking about. I'm pretty sure that it's under duress that this happens, because the condemnation of Aaron here is rather minimal. And in fact, when Aaron dies, there's no mention made of this event. He dies because at the waters of Meribah, he violated, he didn't follow the instructions that God had given him. And it says at the end of this chapter, we're going to end up reading this chapter piecemeal, but let me read just 30 through the end of this chapter 32. And it came about on the next day that Moses said to the people, "You yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I am going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from thy book which thou hast written." And the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. It appears as though the ringleaders were dealt with. But Aaron is not among the ringleaders that's dealt with in that way. And when Aaron is finally put to death, when Aaron dies, there's no mention made of this particular event, which is curious. So Aaron is guilty here, but his complicity is kind of minimized. So I'm not sure what he's thinking. I think at the very beginning, I think his wrong, his error, is he didn't have the fortitude to stand up to the people as Moses would have done in their rebelliousness and call their rebelliousness what it was. Rather, he kind of went along probably for fear that either he would die or he would lose his authority. I'm not sure exactly what he was afraid of. But then as things unfolded, he seems to have thought, well, this isn't such a bad thing after all. I mean, it's not quite kosher, but it has its good points.
Do you know, when Moses confronts him, he was definitely justifying himself.
He covers up.
And blames the people.
Right.
And tries to downplay his active participation in it. Yes. Yes. Well, there's no question but what he realizes at the end, after the fact, for sure, it's clear to him, he had done wrong. Yes?
Maybe that was the difference between him and the leaders that God spoke. His failure was not a failure of his faith, but it was a failure of his ability to do the right thing. Where with them, it was a very hard-hearted, fundamental rebellion. That's
right. That could be.
Is there any indication, David, that these briefs that they tore from their wives, sons, and daughters were slavery from France, from Egypt, or is there any culturally that way that would this completely be ornamental?
I don't know. That's a good question. That's a very good question. I don't know. Yeah, it is. Here it talks about just earrings. Later on, it's all jewelry. It is curious. Kevin?
It occurs to me that maybe Aaron has them tear the earrings off their ears because it would cause disfigurement, which would be a permanent reminder of their complicity.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's one commentator saw this as a means by which Aaron could have was trying to delay, trying to make dissuade them from doing what they were doing, and he tried to do that by making this costly. Maybe. Margaret?
What if the situation were that in itself the making of the calf could have been a neutral thing? It wasn't bad in itself. It was why you were doing what you were doing. And there's a good way you could be doing it and a bad way you could be doing it, or a relatively good way. The relatively good way would be the way that sometimes you see somebody do something and you're fairly certain what they're doing is wrong, and it's not because what they're doing is bad in itself, but you have a fairly good intuition that the reason they're doing it is a faithless reason. And if you wuss out and don't confront them and say, you know, why exactly do you want to do this? One way of wussing out is to decide to interpret their behavior in the best possible way, which lets you off the hook about confronting them. And I just wonder if Aaron initially had the recognition that what they were doing was essentially faithless, but he decided to interpret it in the best possible way, which is, I don't know about this calf thing. Oh, yeah, the calf is Yahweh. Yeah, I understand. That's what you want, really. And so he makes the calf and interprets it in the best possible way, which really isn't what's going on. He's wussing out. And he says, okay, we're going to have a celebration to Yahweh. And the people say, cool, you know, Yahweh, whatever, you know. But this is sort of a question buried in my comments. For some reason, I got the idea that the word play actually referred to literal sexual behavior, not a metaphorical being unfaithful to Yahweh, but they actually were having some kind of a celebration that included promiscuity. And the fact that they would celebrate to Yahweh using something that Yahweh would absolutely hate pretty much gave the game away that they aren't particularly worshiping Yahweh, they just want some god and a god. And doesn't God say to Moses, the people have defiled themselves, polluted themselves, or corrupted themselves? And maybe it was sort of like after you see the way they're celebrating Yahweh in a way that would totally disgust Yahweh, obviously, this is not meant for Yahweh's edification or praise or anything like that. This really gives it away who you think you're really worshiping. And maybe that was the thing that really, you know, if they had actually worshiped Yahweh in a way that Yahweh would have liked, it wouldn't have been a big deal. I mean, it still would have been faithless in the sense that they, you know, after God has gone through all this, is he really going to let Moses, you know, we don't know what's happened to Moses, but whatever we know, God will not let us down. Let's just hang out and figure out what God's going to do. That would have been the more faithful perspective. But it's sort of understandable that you don't know what's going on, and maybe this is what we need to do. You know, maybe he has been killed by a beast. So I'm just wondering, is sort of the inherent ambiguity of their behavior and Aaron's wussing out, and then it just their literal sexual behavior gives it away what they're really doing, and that's what God is responding to. And he says they've corrupted themselves. A lot of times sexual sin is seen as a sin against your own self, and I wonder if that's the essence of they've corrupted themselves. Yeah.
The verb here that they rose up and played, the word can mean literally to play like a child, or it can mean to engage in sexual behavior. And some commentators take it that way, that it devolved into an orgy. And I don't know whether that's the case or not, but I think in any case, the author is indicating that anyone with eyes to see could see that this was truly an illicit kind of celebration. It was not consistent with worship of Yahweh.
And verse yes. 1 and 5,
I'm sorry,
Moses indicates that Aaron has let the people get out of control.
Yes.
And maybe play that was started was, and what ended up was not the intended play.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. The thing spun out of control, and that's a curious thing because, if I'm reading this correctly, Aaron gave in to the pressure in order to retain a sense of control and order. He was afraid of things blowing up. So he capitulated, and what is the end result of his capitulation? Things spin out of control and out of order.
Maybe this brings you back to your question Logan asked, but it is interesting that Paul quotes the verse that you're talking about in 1 Corinthians, but he describes it, and do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. That kind of brings us back to the question of what is going on, right? Paul is describing that scene there with the gold calf as idolatry.
Yes. Yes. That's what's I've been kind of churning on in recent weeks is what is idolatry? I used to think that idolatry was when you make this statue and you worship it instead of God. But I'm beginning to suspect that that's not at the heart of what idolatry is, and that they're really there's not much relationship between the two. That idolatry is worshiping God on our terms. I think that that's what it's pointing at, and that's something that you guys can be thinking about and reflect back on what we've covered. But I'm beginning to suspect that that's what really at the heart of what idolatry is. I think of it in terms of every once in a while I have this discussion with my children about the difference between a demand and a request. That sometimes they'll come and very politely, using words that you would think come with a request, but in fact it's a demand. The only way you can really tell the difference sometimes is how do they respond when you say no. If it is a request, then a no is not seen as some wrong done to them. They are coming truly as a suppliant, asking a favor. And if you say no, then that's fine, because they realize that they are coming as a suppliant. But if they come with a demand and you say no, then but they have been wronged. They have rights, and those rights have been violated. And in our relationship with God, I think what the commandment against idolatry is saying is, do not become confused as to who is creator and who is creature, as to who is master and who is servant. When you come to me on my terms, not on your terms. When you come to me as a suppliant, not as someone who has rights and privileges and can insist upon those. When you come to me to worship me, you worship on my terms. You worship me as I prescribe, not on your terms, and when you want, and where you want, and as you want, and etc. One of the things that's very curious here is they create this calf, and if Umberto Casuto is right, it's as a seat for God to come and be present. And they are doing this at approximately the same time as God is giving Moses instructions on the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, on which in between the cherubim is the mercy seat where God will come and reside. Why is one idolatry and the other one not? And I think the answer is, it's really, ultimately, it's determined by our spirit as we come. And one can only build an idol on their own initiative, just making this calf and worship it, thinking in terms of coming and making God dance to our tune. It can't be done any other way. So ultimately, I think it's the spirit that determines, are we coming as a suppliant or are we coming as a manipulator? Are we coming making requests of God? Are we coming making demands of God? And idolatry is confusing the two. Idolatry is saying, ultimately, it's what I want that's important. It's that my will be done that's important. However that's done, what God is insisting is that it is His will to be done, and that we see that as good and resolve ourselves to that. Yes?
I just wanted to add that since the fall of man, since men committed high treason against God, it's been a fight and a war of principalities and powers of darkness against us. What it is itself, and our desires, just like you were saying. But we also have an enemy, an unseen enemy, and he comes to kill, steal, and destroy. And he's been doing that since the fall of man. And he does it with intimidation, with like Aaron. You know, he wanted to intimidate, and the more people see the power of agreement, is it works both ways, where the two or more agree is touch one thing. I mean, it shall be given. That's established, whether it's for good or for evil. God said it, and it will happen. So when those people agreed, the strength and the intimidation against Aaron, he fell for it too. And what do we always do? We blame, because self couldn't do it. Adam blamed Eve. I mean, you know, it's constant blame. Blame, that's, you know, what we do. And it's the spirit realm. It's the principalities and powers of darkness, too. You know, we have an enemy in this life. We will, you know. And it's like he's, you know, it's the oppression of the enemy and it's the intimidation of the enemy. And he was gone so long, you know, it's like, well, we'll just do our own thing. And it's self. But it's because of the spirit realm, you know, that it's our choices, basically. It's simple. It's good against evil, you know, and it's been that way forever. I mean, you know, and it'll always be that way till he returns, you know. So, but it's self. Basically, it's self and our wants and our needs, and we don't have a God, so let's build one, you know. And that's what Satan's all about, is self. He wanted to be God. And when he gets in our hearts, then other things happen. So the opposite of love is self. And that's what happened to those people. They weren't loving, they weren't seeking. And here God just performed a major miracle for them. Healed every one of them. Split the sea for them. Anyway, go ahead and just want to share
that. I think that's
right from the beginning, the most consistent problem you see in man is wanting to invert creature and creator. It is so difficult for us as human beings to allow God to be God. And that it's only by the grace of God that is overcome. Okay, thanks.